Thanks for being with us here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Between now and next month's general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. And right now we're talking to the candidates running for the 3rd Congressional District in Southeast Wisconsin, which includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. Democrat Ron Kind is the incumbent in the race. Facing him, Republican Derek Van Orden. A quick note, both candidates will participate in a virtual debate on Monday, October 26th at 10 o'clock in the morning. That airs on the Ideas Network stations in southwestern, west central, and central Wisconsin. Now we talk to Derek Van Orden. He's a retired Navy SEAL and owns a small hobby farm in Hager City. Derek, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be able to speak to you today.
We appreciate your time here. One of the things you're running on is it being in favor of repealing the Affordable Care Act. And if you successfully repeal that major healthcare overhaul, what do you want to see passed in its place?
Right. Let me be super clear before we get into this question. Unfortunately, Ron Kind has been lying directly to the people in the 3rd District repeatedly about my stance on pre-existing conditions. And I think he's going to probably wind up firing his fact checker, because I am a 100% service-connected disabled veteran, and I have children with very serious orthopedic issues, which are pre-existing conditions. So I will never sign on to any healthcare program. I won't even discuss it unless there's rock solid provisions to take care of folks with pre-existing conditions, period. So everything you're hearing out of Ron Kind and the left is a lie. And unfortunately, we're just used to it from then. So that's where we start.
Derek, just a second then. One moment then. So does that mean that you wouldn't repeal the Affordable Care Act unless there was something in place to account for pre-existing conditions, or are these separate issues for you?
No, I think they're the same issues.
Okay.
And we can do more things at once. We have to be able to work together to get this done. And we just can't have politics as usual anymore. We just cannot afford to have politics as usual. We are a generous nation. We're a kind nation. We're a giving nation. And we can take care of those who need it the most. And those are folks that have pre-existing conditions. So that's just a ruse from the left. And again, Ron's been lying about this for a couple months now. And quite frankly, it's why people don't like politicians like Ron Kind. We have to take care of those with pre-existing conditions, then move on from that direction. We've got to get the government out of private industries. The reason that Ron Kind is such a fan of the Affordable Care Act is because his primary donors are big pharma, medical insurance companies, some hospital consortiums, and then insurance companies. So these special interest groups have given Ron Kind millions and millions of dollars over the years, because they've made billions of dollars off the American taxpayers through the horrible ACA. That's just a fact. He's making millions of dollars. These insurance companies are making billions of dollars, and we're paying for it. And I'm done with that.
So, Derek, you would want to do what then if the ACA is repealed?
I want to have a health care plan that makes sure we absolutely cover folks with pre-existing conditions, and that we move government out of the private health care.
All right. Well, let's stay on the healthcare track. Wisconsin hitting record highs this week, record highs today when we are looking at positive test results for COVID-19, also looking at hospitalizations and deaths. As a member of Congress, how would you work to help slow COVID spread in your district and our state?
Well, I listen to the folks in the district and do a tailored response. So when we first did the initial lockdown in the entire state, we have 18 whole and partial counties in this district. And when this first started happening, and we got to the big spike, there were 7 counties in the state of Wisconsin that had more COVID cases than all 18 in my district. So taking the one size fits all approach doesn't work. We have to be able to get back to having our economy open safely, effectively, efficiently, and quickly, so that we can get back to work and get back to living our lives as Americans.
And as a member of Congress, then, how would you make that possible? How would you try to, I guess, create local control or make sure it's not one size fits all?
I would make sure that the funding that was directed from Congress is focused specifically on COVID relief. Now, Ron Kind and Nancy Pelosi have insisted that they give $1,200 to illegal immigrants in stimulus money. That has nothing to do with the citizens here in the third district of the state of Wisconsin. They've packed trillions of dollars of this left-wing kind of dream sheet into what is allegedly COVID relief, including the Green New Deal. That has nothing to do with COVID relief. When I get to Congress, I'm going to work very, very hard so that we do clean bills. For instance, if we need to get another $1,200 stimulus check out to American citizens, that's great. Let's do that right now. It should be a clean bill, not a 2,700-page wish list from the left. We have to focus on helping people where they need help and not trying to fulfill individual political wish lists. This is about the American citizens. It's about our fellow man here in the state of Wisconsin. It's not supposed to be about political expediencies for folks. It just isn't. And I think the more we go down this road, and if you start looking at Amy Coney Barrett now, how this is how she's been treated, we can see that the left is politicizing absolutely everything, and it's inappropriate.
Republican Derek Van Orden is running as a Republican to represent Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, and we're talking to him here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Derek, you mentioned the economy. We saw Wisconsin's economy shrink by almost 33% between just April and June compared to the first 3 months of the year. President Donald Trump has called off talks on a relief package until after the November 3rd election. So how do you want to see Congress and the president work together to figure this out?
Well, I think we talked about that just a minute ago. What the president wants to see is a clean bill. He wants to see focused relief for our folks. He doesn't want to see this wish list of Green New Deal that has nothing to do with COVID relief. That's what the president wants to do. And as a matter of fact, he sent a tweet specifically to Nancy Pelosi telling her that he'd be willing to sign a $1,200 relief package right now. Well, they've ignored that. They keep putting politics above the welfare of our folks here in the third and across the nation. And it's unacceptable. We have to stop playing politics with American people's lives. And that's exactly what I'll do when I get to Washington, D.C. I served for 26 years and 21 as a SEAL. I have 5 combat tours. And if we behaved like this, in the SEAL teams, we wouldn't be in the SEAL teams very long. So it's time for a real change in Washington, D.C., and that simply is not Ron Kind. He has run his course, and he has shown that he's had zero legislative accomplishments in the past 24 years, and he just wants to stay in D.C. collecting money. Well, we're done with that. We're at a crisis point in our nation now, and we need to stop all this silliness and get to work for America.
Derek, we've seen unrest around the country, all over the world, really, when we see law enforcement interactions and communities of color. Hits home here in Wisconsin with the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. How do you see lawmakers working to restore trust between the police and people of color?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. Is there room for improvement in relationships between our citizens and officials? 100%. But we have to make sure that we understand that our law enforcement officers are not the enemy. They get up every single day and they put body armor on to go to work. And I'd like you to think about that. These are American citizens that put body armor on to go protect other American citizens every day, and they're being vilified. So we cannot do that with our law enforcement officials. Let me tell you something about law enforcement and Ron Kind. He had a phone call with our 18 county sheriffs here in the district and lied to them. He said that he'd always have their back when it regards to removal of qualified immunity, which is a way to defund the police. It is. But what he failed to mention to them was that 8 days before that phone call, he actually co-sponsored the bill that removed qualified immunity from all police officers at a federal level. That's why 13 of the 18 county sheriffs representing over 500,000 people in my district are publicly endorsing me, including Democrats. Ron Kind has thrown the police under the bus one too many times, and they're absolutely sick and tired of it. We have to work together as public officials and private citizens. And you don't do that by flat out lying to their faces. You just don't do that. And that's what Ron has been doing for years. And he just got caught doing this yet again about a month ago.
Why do you think that you should replace Ron Kind in Congress?
Well, number one, I've got a great work ethic. And he skipped about 150 of his committee meetings and countless amounts of votes throughout the year. Number two, I'll never lie to my constituents ever. I just won't. I certainly won't lie to our police officers, and I'm not going to lie to the people who vote for me. People are expecting me to go to Washington, D.C. to work as hard as I possibly can and put their interest above my own. And I have a 26-year record of tested and proven leadership doing exactly that, putting other people's best interests, my nation, my district, my family, above my own. And Ron simply does not have that. He's become a millionaire in office, which should enrage every person. He's taken millions and millions of dollars through special interest to enrich himself and maintain his position of power in office. And that's just not how we can run our country any longer.
Derek, thank you for your time today.
Well, you know what? Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Derek Van Orden running in the November 3rd general election. He's a retired Navy SEAL and also owns a small hobby farm in Hager City. He's running as a Republican to represent the 3rd congressional district in southeast Wisconsin that includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. And he faces Democratic incumbent Ron Kind. We talk to Ron Kind next. Between now and the November general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in these contested races for congressional seats for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews and learn more about the candidates and the races at WPR.org/politics. Stay with us. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Now we are talking to another candidate running for the 3rd Congressional District in southeast Wisconsin, which includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. Earlier, we talked to Derek Van Orden, a Republican candidate. Facing him is Democrat Ron Kind. He's held a seat in Congress since 1997. Representative Ron Kind, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, good afternoon, Keeley, and do give my best to Rob Ferret.
We will, definitely. Let's start right at this idea about law enforcement interacting with Black Americans in recent months, especially after the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. How do you think lawmakers can work to restore trust between communities of color and police forces?
Well, that's a great question. It's really the question of our time, too. Now is the time for leadership to bring people together, to strengthen trust in law enforcement, but also to show respect to everyone who deserves it. And there's work to be done on that front. Listen, I'm a former prosecutor, special prosecutor here in western Wisconsin. I have a younger brother who's been a police officer for 24 years. We need them to be successful in protecting lives in our community. But we also need a law enforcement force that's respectful of all people, regardless of background, color, creed. And there's more work to be done on that front.
Yeah, how can you, as a member of Congress, help that along?
Well, I've been one of the leading advocates for increasing resources for de-escalation training, implicit bias training. I've also been supportive of Burn Justice grant funding and community-oriented policing programs. And fortunately, here in Wisconsin, they do a really good job with these training programs. And I've met with a lot of law enforcement, those who go through these programs, and they have nothing but high praise for it. And it is important that we get the community's trust up for law enforcement. You know, most of them, I know, having worked with them personally, are outstanding public servants trying to do the best job they can in our community. But all too often now we're seeing those instances of where we've got unarmed Black men being shot or an officer kneeling on a Black man's neck who's lying face down, handcuffed behind his back for 9 minutes until he's dead. And clearly that's not right, and that needs to get fixed.
Let's talk about the pandemic. COVID-19 is absolutely raging. We've got more than 3,700 new positive tests in Wisconsin since yesterday afternoon. And this week we've set records with deaths and hospitalizations. How do you plan to work to curb the virus's spread in our state and your district?
Well, this is an all-hands-on-deck moment, and we all have a responsibility to each other to keep each other safe. We are literally only as healthy as the closest person next to us with this global pandemic. Now is the time for us to depoliticize the situation, follow the best medical and scientific guidance that's available based on the research that has already been done, and exercise some responsibility to one another. And clearly the direction's heading in the wrong way in Wisconsin with high positivity rate again, high hospitalization rate. We had the single highest death rate for our state just this week, and we have to work together to overcome it. And that's why I've done basically a public service announcement telling people we know what we have to do to protect each other. Wash our hands a lot. practice proper distancing, and please wear a face mask. It's not a red issue. This isn't a blue issue. It's a red, white, and blue issue. By working together, we can defeat this virus and emerge even stronger. But clearly, we've let our guard down, and it is spreading at dangerous levels, and there's work to be done.
Democratic U.S. Representative Ron Kind is running for another term to represent the 3rd Congressional District in southwestern Wisconsin. And this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to this interview on Central Time. Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act. Derek Van Orden, who is also running to represent the 3rd Congressional District, opposes the Affordable Care Act. You voted to pass Obamacare. What do you plan to do to uphold that sweeping health care reform?
Well, unfortunately, President Trump and the Republican Party is doing everything they can to completely repeal the Affordable Care Act. If they succeed before the Supreme Court, and oral arguments are going to be had in about 1 month here, you know, people with pre-existing conditions will no longer be protected in our health care system. They can be denied coverage. They can be charged extra. And before passage of the Affordable Care Act, just being a woman was considered a pre-existing condition because women have babies. That's wrong, and that was fixed in the Affordable Care Act. And also in the act are a prohibition against annual and lifetime payment limits that insurance companies used to practice before passage of the Affordable Care Act. That means if you contract cancer, as my son did last year, you could blow through that annual or lifetime limits in a heartbeat. And that's not right. And that was fixed, too. Young adults can stay on their parents' plans till 26. Can't tell you how many parents have come up to me thanking me that they have that option now for their young adult children. And seniors in Medicare get now free prevention and wellness visits. Low-income families get tax credits so they can go in the exchange and afford a quality, comprehensive health plan for their family needs. I'm just wondering what my opponent opposes under the Affordable Care Act and what his alternative would be if this is completely repealed. It would result in chaos, millions of Americans losing their health care coverage overnight, and the patient protections disappearing. And I don't believe most Wisconsinites want to see that happen. But there's room for improvement. And I've been the leading voice to change the way we pay for health care. So it's based on the value or the outcome of care that's given, so we can get better care at a much better price, because I think we can all acknowledge that health care is still way too expensive in our country.
Your challenger says that he is in favor of protecting pre-existing conditions, but that he wants the government out of health care. Do you see that as the answer to improving some of the deficiencies of the Affordable Care Act?
My opponent can't have it both ways. Those protections are in place under the current law, under the Affordable Care Act, that he's trying to repeal. And, you know, what else is he in favor of that he's not admitting under the Act? You know, the great irony of the Affordable Care Act is it got caught in this political vortex, and it was labeled Obamacare, and therefore partisan divisions developed. But if you look at the individual components of the Affordable Care Act, there's wide bipartisan support for it when you cut through all the political partisan rhetoric around it. I'm always open for better ideas, Keeley, and I'm part of a bipartisan healthcare innovation caucus that I'm co-chairing, and we are exploring areas of common ground that we can improve the healthcare system. But we've got to end this constant political fight that seems to be an argument without end surrounding the Affordable Care Act, acknowledge what's working, fix what isn't, and deliver more affordable health care to all Americans.
Let's make sure we touch on the economy. Wisconsin's economy shrunk by nearly a third in the second quarter this year compared to the first. How do you plan to help the businesses in Wisconsin bounce back?
Well, our state and our national economy will only be as healthy as America's health. And that's why, again, we have to defeat the virus and prevent its spread and prevent the loss of life, or people aren't going to have confidence to return to work or to go out and patronize our small businesses here in Wisconsin. So this is inextricably bound together, that we've got to keep people healthy. We've got to stop the spread of this virus. And when we all start practicing those steps, we're going to be able to safely reopen things again, from businesses to our schools, with students returning to the classroom. But to pretend that you can separate the two, I think, is senseless. And unfortunately, I see my opponent out there in large group gatherings, no facial covering, hugging people and shaking hands, everything that's contrary to the medical advice and medical guidance that's being issued right now. And there's little wonder then that we've got this huge spike in the virus spreading in Wisconsin and throughout most of America. We got to get on the same page. Again, this can't be a red or a blue issue. We're all Americans. We have a responsibility to each other to keep each other safe, and we know what works. Face coverings prevent 95% of the transmission of this virus. And it's not asking a lot for people to be respectful to one another when they go out in public and put a face cover on.
What about the financial implications here? How do you, as a member of Congress, want to work with the president to try to help people who are financially hit by COVID-19?
Yeah, we do need another COVID package, and it should be bipartisan. I did not believe that when we passed the CARES Act earlier in the year that this virus would be over by September or October. Clearly, it's not done with us yet. Small businesses are suffering. We should have a renewal of the Paycheck Protection Program and EIDL grants that I was supportive of. Our schools are encouraging cleaning expenses that they didn't budget for. Our healthcare providers, and I meet with them every week on virtual meetings, are telling me they're running short of personal protection equipment, the reagents for testing, contact tracing isn't where it needs to be. They need some additional assistance. And we have too many people who are still laid off or furloughed, who are having a hard time now paying their bills. And this recession that we're in right now doesn't have to last as long, be as deep, and be as damaging, as long as we're willing to continue to take short-term measures to support businesses, support families, support our family farmers, and buy some time until we can develop a safe and effective vaccine and start inoculating people. And that's what this is about right now, is trying to buy that time until our best researchers can make these breakthroughs that they're on the verge of doing, and people have the confidence and the trust to get inoculated then.
Yeah. Representative Kind, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Keely. My pleasure.
That's Ron Kind. He's a Democratic U.S. representative from the 3rd Congressional District in southwestern Wisconsin, which includes La Crosse and Eau Claire. He has represented the district since 1997 and is running to serve another term. He faces Republican Derek Van Orden. The general election is November 3rd. Both candidates are set to participate in a virtual debate on Monday, October 26th. It happens at 10 o'clock in the morning on the Ideas Network stations in southwestern, west central, and central Wisconsin. You can find all of our interviews and learn more about the candidates in races at WPR.org/politics. Coming up, we've got a conversation about money in politics. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, with just more than 2 weeks until Election Day, we check in with two officials. We're talking about how to successfully cast your vote this year, and we're learning what it takes to count more than a million absentee ballots. Join us tomorrow morning. Now, it's Central Time. America's faith in our government has gone down over the years, with people saying they don't trust it to do the right thing. And one culprit that gets the blame, money and campaign spending. Advocates for stricter campaign finance laws say they would go a long way in restoring that trust. But our next guests say that's not necessarily the case. They've done years worth of surveys on how people feel about money in politics, and they find that even new rules on campaign spending aren't likely to get rid of dissatisfaction with our political system. It's time to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. What would make you have more faith in government than you do right now? How do you think about it when it comes to campaign finance? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Primo is a professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester. He's co-author of the new book, Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. Dave, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Jeff Milo is a professor and chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri. He's also a co-author on that new book. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Dave, politicians from both parties talk about money and corruption, and campaign finance reform is often framed as this way to restore people's trust in government. And you write that that conversation is pretty far afield from real data about what new laws could realistically do. Where do you see the gaps?
The challenge with campaign finance reform is, and its effects on trust in government, is that is that mistrust of government runs so much deeper than money. And if you ask the public to define what corruption is, they define corruption so broadly that acts that we would think of as normal politics, so trying to secure media coverage, essentially representing your constituents, if you frame it in the right way, the public will think that that is corrupt behavior, and they often ascribe malign motives to, especially to the other party with regard to corruption. So the public's distrust and distaste for politics just runs so deep that campaign finance reform isn't going to move the needle much. And we find that both in recent surveys and over the last 30 years, looking at surveys that others have done.
Is campaign finance a little bit of a scapegoat for our lack of trust in our systems?
Money is, without a doubt, an easy target, right? It's easy to measure, right? We get reports, especially in election season like we're in now, about how much the candidates are spending. If you ask the public, they will say that money is corrupting. And as a result, it's a very easy sell for politicians to say that we need to do more to regulate money in politics. But the reality is that once you actually implement these laws, as we've shown at the state level, using state-level data, if you look at changes in state campaign finance laws, they've had virtually no effect on how the public perceives government.
Jeff, the question you're looking at is not so much whether campaign finance laws are good or bad, but if they would achieve that stated goal. One of those is restoring public faith in government. So how do you investigate whether reforms actually do that?
Well, and that's a great observation to start with, too. So much of the public conversation about campaign finance laws is, sort of presumes their effects and then talks about whether they're good or bad. As social scientists, we really want to focus on what are the effects of these reforms in practice. And so we go about this in a number of different ways in the book, but the sort of what I think of as the crowning chapter, where we look at the effects of state campaign finance laws on trust in state government, we use the states as laboratories. And so over the last 30 years, there've been a lot of changes in state campaign finance laws. Wisconsin has public financing and has more regulations. Down here in Missouri, at least until very recently, it was kind of like the Wild West. Anyone could give any amount to state candidates. So there's a lot of variation across states and over time. And we exploit that variation to then say, when you see changes in these laws at the state level, do you see corresponding changes in trust in state government? And the answer is no.
No, because people still say they don't trust it roughly as much, or why? Do we know?
Well, whatever their baseline trust, there's no change. It's not responsive to changes in campaign finance laws. And there's a number of reasons that might be. One is probably a lot of people aren't aware of what the campaign finance laws in their state. So there's not going to really be a direct effect. But if you think that reform is going to transform politics in some dramatic way, that should be noticed. And you don't get that indirect effect either. And it's, the way we summarize it is the reason campaign finance reforms don't work in practice the way reformers think they will, it's because the world doesn't work the way reformers think it does. Money is simply not the driving force in American politics that it is often taken for granted to be.
Jeff Milo and David Primo wrote a book about campaign finance reform and whether changing the rules would actually help people have more faith in our systems. What do you think? 800-642-1234. Would stricter campaign finance laws make a difference in how you view politics? If you see money and corruption in politics as a serious problem, what regulations do you think could help solve it? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Dave, you asked people about a variety of campaign finance reforms, from public funding of campaigns to limits on spending from corporations and unions. What did people think would do some good, and what are they less optimistic about?
Generally speaking, the American public is largely in support of disclosure if you frame the question as disclosure for others. They're less favorable toward disclosure, but still modestly favorable when it comes to disclosure for themselves. So it's we want other people to disclose their contributions, but we'd like to keep our own contributions to ourselves. So that's sort of an inconsistency there. But disclosure tends to be fairly popular. What isn't particularly popular are restrictions on how much super PACs can give. Actually, a majority does not support restrictions on super PACs, which we found surprising, given how they're portrayed in the media. But they do support, for instance, spending limits on what corporations can spend on politics and even what candidates can spend on politics, which also surprised us because that has been all of those are not currently restricted. So I think that's sort of the big surprise there in our findings.
James on Facebook said we should strip all businesses and corporations, with the exception of the press, of their constitutional rights. Rights should belong only to people. Jeff, do you have a response for James when he's weighing in on this?
Well, that's his opinion. That's fair enough. The Supreme Court disagrees. And so we kind of deal in the world of what the laws are, what the changes in the laws have been, and what the effects of them are. So again, we're not in the business of advocating for or against things. And but we love people who advocate, but we want them to be well informed about how money in politics really works and what the likely effects of changes to laws would be. And just to piggyback off of what Dave said just a moment ago, not only, I mean, the American public is, if you ask them directly about limits on campaign contributions and the like, they're generally favorable, but they're particularly, there's some hurt certain hot button words you can use to gin up more support in a survey. So if you frame things as limiting money, especially from corporations and especially to candidates in the other party, you'll get a lot more support. If you instead frame that question as limiting the ability of people to support like-minded candidates, you get much less support. And so a public opinion, while generally favorable of limits on money in politics, is actually pretty easy to manipulate through the survey frames.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jeff, I heard you say, you know, you want an informed public, and I can't overlook the fact that chapters in your book are the uninformed public, the malleable public, the cynical public, the pragmatic public. I mean, what do you want to say about the actual information and knowledge of the public at large?
Well, one of the things we point to in the uninformed public is, this is probably not very surprising, campaign finance law is complex. But if you ask people kind of a quiz about campaign finance laws, they do no better than random guessing. So people really aren't very informed about what laws exist. And so if they were to express a preference for reform, they may actually be desiring something that already exists in practice. So people are pretty uninformed. But we shouldn't expect them to be well-informed. They got better things to do, for goodness sake. And so, you know, that's not a criticism of the public, but it's something we should be aware of when interpreting, you know, public opinion. They say that's favorable toward reform. Basically, people don't know what they're talking about. And so, you know, hopefully folks can get more who are interested can read our book and get more informed about what the state of laws are and what their actual effects are in practice.
We're talking with Jeff Milo and Dave Primo right now, authors of the book Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. And we're taking your calls. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. We continue this conversation ahead on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with Dave Primo and Jeff Milo, authors of the new book, Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. And we're taking your calls. We want to welcome Gwen from Madison now. Hi, Gwen.
Hello. Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi. What's on your mind as we talk about this?
Well, I think that trust in government could be restored if the campaign finance laws were changed to.
Oh, and we may have lost you, Gwen. Gwen was going to talk about trust in government would be more if the PACs were eliminated and if candidates could then have to directly appeal to constituents for money instead of having these major funders. Dave, is that something that you looked into in this book, and what did you find?
Well, that, you know, I appreciate Gwen's question, and it plays into a problem we identify in the book, which is that the American public thinks that PACs and super PACs have this significant influence on campaign financing. But the reality is that super PACs are actually a very small proportion of overall spending. In fact, small donors, donors who give under $200, now account for more fundraising from that candidates do than super PACs and PACs do. And so the idea that PACs and corporations are flooding the system with money. We hear a lot of these water terms in campaign finance, the tsunami of money, a flooding of money, just isn't borne out in reality. And this goes back to what Jeff was talking about earlier with regard to the importance of having accurate information, in part because of the way the media covers campaign finance. They'll often focus on super PACs and PACs and corporate giving, and that creates misperceptions, we would argue, in terms of how the public perceives the issue, and as a result, it may be skewing their preferences as a consequence. So, again, the fact is, when you ask the public, you know, what percentage of spending comes from super PACs, their answers are wildly inaccurate. And we would argue, again, that's why it's really important to have accurate information about the prevalence of this kind of funding in American politics.
Thanks for the call, Gwen. We appreciate it. Now we've got Richard in Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Richard.
Hello. I would like to ask the panel, well, since they think that campaign finance reform is not as big as it appears to be, what do they think about term limits and which one would have the greater impact in bringing back public trust? Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Jeff, what do you think? Have you explored term limits and how that plays into this conversation about campaign finance reform?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a great way to think, which is, if the science says this isn't very effective, what about this other policy? And term limits, as you know, if we were to go back, even 30 years ago, Republicans especially were pushing those as, again, the magic wand that would increase trust in government. We'd have more of a citizen legislature. And there's several books that have been written already on the topic. And I think the conventional wisdom among American political scientists would be that term limits have had some unintended negative consequences in terms of having legislators that have maybe a little bit less expertise. But, we now have some states with term limits, some states without, and they're a little more popular in the states with them. But it certainly hasn't been a cure-all. And I have in other work looked a little bit at the effects of term limits on trust in state government, and there's nothing big going on there. So one of the things we argue in this book is that American cynicism and mistrust of government, as Dave put it before, it's very deep-seated and deep-rooted, and I might argue even healthy. But the idea that some reform is going to be a cure-all and dramatically change that turns out to be wishful thinking.
Jeff Milo and David Primo wrote a book about campaign finance reform, what people think and what might or might not reassure us when it comes to trust in government. You're listening to the Ideas Network. And now I want to welcome Dan from Madison. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Yes. Terms like American cynicism and American mistrust in government, those are such broad brush statements. Those are you're referring to American consciousness on a grand scale, and your evidence that it doesn't work. It was brought out by saying that you guys have or you've done research on targeted areas in small or state level, municipalities and things of that sort. How can you expect for something so broad to be affected when you're making changes on such a small scale? And how do you expect that to happen so quickly? We need generations reform and change in campaign finance and to take money out of politics in order for attitudes on a grand scale to change.
Yeah, Dan, thank you for that. I want to jump in here because I want to make sure our guests have an opportunity to respond. Dave, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I understand the caller's perspective. But what we did in the state level analysis was look at this is sort of state of the art social science where you look at a change in a law and think of it as an intervention and then observe what the effects are. And to be clear, a couple of things are really important to mention here. One, it wasn't us who necessarily came up with the hypothesis that campaign finance reforms would have a meaningful effect on trust in government. This is what reformers have been promising to Americans for decades now. They've been promising these big effects. We have several quotes in the book, and we could have filled a chapter with just quotations from politicians, reformers, scholars arguing this point. So it's really reformers who are making this point. The second reason why this matters is that the Supreme Court has said it matters. So the Supreme Court has said that one of the only two justifications for restrictions on political speech are, in this context, are to prevent corruption, of which we actually don't have as much actual corruption as people think in American democracy, but to prevent corruption or the appearance of democracy. So public perceptions are at the root of Supreme Court jurisprudence on campaign finance. So the studies we're doing, we would argue, are the most comprehensive that have been done on this question to date. And I sort of one last point, and then I'll let Jeff add his thoughts. Is right now we're having a lot of debate over a COVID-19 vaccine, and you see a lot of calls for a need for science and for transparency and for evidence about the effectiveness of the vaccine. We would argue that we need the same level of scrutiny on political reforms because they also have very significant consequences for our society, specifically for democracy.
Hmm. Jeff, just a minute left here. What do you want people to know?
Well, you know, I think the bottom line here, you know, that there's not that much corruption, that money is not as big a driving force as many people think. This is really great news. This is a happy story about American democracy. And so some people react to this very strongly and negatively, thinking, you know, we have to deny the science. It must be wrong. Sometimes science can bring about good news. And so for me, that's maybe the bottom line here.
A happy story about campaign finance. Don't hear that very often, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Dave, we appreciate you joining us.
It was great to be back with you.
David Primo is a professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester, and Jeff Milo is a professor and chair of the economics department at the University of Missouri. They talked with us about their book, Campaign Finance and American Democracy, What the Public Really Thinks and Why It Matters. And coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we are less than 3 weeks from a general election. We're talking about stories of people in Wisconsin who were instrumental in women gaining the right to vote. And we are talking about disease outbreaks before COVID-19, learning about how they changed cultures and communities. Those stories and more coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time. it's time for one of those message in a bottle stories. This one, more of a message on a boat. In 1993, elementary students launched a boat from Duluth, Minnesota, a small toy boat. This month, a couple found it washed up near Ashland, Wisconsin. That's 27 years later. The bottom of the boat had this note: I am traveling to the ocean. Please put me back in the water. Will you send information on your whereabouts to Lakewood School, rooms 116 and 118? And then the address. It turns out two kids launched two boats on a field trip with their classes. They'd painted them and added the message to the bottom. One washed up about a year later and then went back into the water. And one of those kids who's now an adult says she didn't think she'd hear any more about it and that it's amazing that the boat is still out there. And it is. That's because the couple that found it on October 7th, they snapped some pictures, relaunched it into the water, and watched it sail again in the waves of a great lake. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.